And streaming it to Facebook.
Okay, we'll officially start the meeting now since it's essentially 7:30. And would you like to tell us something about telescopes?
Yeah.
Guy?
We are renaming the telescope making workshop into TM3W, which stands for Telescope Making, Modification, and Maintenance Workshop. Because a lot of what we do is help people fix something that's wrong with their telescope or modify it. And right now, we're modifying some venerable a telescope mount that we have out of the Hopewell Observatory, which had an Ealing mount that used to belong to the University of Maryland. And they got rid of it and sold it to NCA, and NCA sold it to us. And the motors have always been a little wonky and have caused a lot of people a lot of problems. So we had a sort of a catastrophic failure in the motors because the clutches failed. And I've been hearing about something called OnStep, which is an open source free program, or you can use off-the-shelf components like stepper motors you can buy anywhere, and connectors, and the boards are easily checked. And we're having great success. The learning curve was pretty amazing. I had to learn how to, do a little bit of programming. Had a lot of help and hand-holding from people who knew what they were talking about. We went out today, and it is working. So if you have a old equatorial mount that the drive isn't working so well, consider doing the OnStep mount process. It's not simple, it's not trivial. You have to learn a lot about software and hardware, but it can be done. And I think by the spring, knock on wood, throw salt over your shoulder or whatever, I hope that we will be able to have guests again at Hopewell Observatory and show off this new system, which will be go-to.
How expensive is this system?
The whole expense, I think it's going to be a couple hundred dollars total.
Oh, not too bad.
We've actually gotten donations of almost everything.
Shush, quiet.
The other alternative is to go with something called Sidereal Technologies. It's a company headed by Dan Gray, and that's several thousand dollars.
Very good.
That's my news.
Another good astronomical society to join is the Greenbelt Astronomical Society. They meet on Thursdays, which knocks me out most of the time because I'm teaching then, but occasionally in the summertime, I can go to their good meetings. They also have a lot of they do a lot of Zoom meetings with at other times with telescopes and do fantastic things. And I'm going to rely on some of them.
Yes, Sue Bassett is the right person for that
organization as well.
Harold, you're on the top of the world.
Okay.
Hey, if I may pick up where Harold left off. Because of Thanksgiving this month, the Astronomical Society of Greenbelt is meeting a week early. So our meeting will be next Thursday. And I am giving the presentation. It's on the astronomical aspects of ice age extinctions. And I call it Fantastic Beasts and Why You Can't Find Them.
Cool.
So that will be a Zoom meeting, 7:30 next Thursday.
Push.
And you're going to record it too, I hope.
Yes, we record them.
Yeah.
How do we get access?
Are you on the NCA mailing list?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I will send out something to the groups.io that has the access.
Appreciate it.
Okay.
He's actually a journalist, so it's good to keep him in your good graces.
No, not really. I'm a novelist and a poet.
Okay.
Okay.
But I appreciate it, and I'll pass on whatever.
Okay. Well, it's a little bit different angle on things, but it's still astronomy related. So we'll see how that goes.
Jack, you have a question?
Jack, why don't you tell us about the Mid-Atlantic Planetarium Society meeting?
You're muted.
Mid-Atlantic Planetarium, Mid-Atlantic Senior Physicists Group.
You're muted, Jack.
He's not muted, but his microphone is misbehaving and it's coming out as some kind of really bizarre thing. So now, there we go. Try again. Jack, speak.
Is that better?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. There are two settings in my microphone, and sometimes the ghost in the machine switches it. Okay. The next Wednesday, November 17, at 1 p.m., the Mid-Atlantic Senior Physicist Group will have a Zoom presentation. Progress toward high-gain inertial confinement fusion with lasers, given by Stephen Obenshain from the Plasma Physics Division at the Naval Research Laboratory. You can sign on anytime after 12:30. There is an announcement and a bio and an abstract on page 7 of the November Stardust. Also, there's also a link there to join the meeting. Everyone's welcome.
Hey, Dave, is there something really exciting on occultations that's about to occur?
The most exciting thing is what just happened. Thursday evening, we had an occultation by a Kuiper Belt object, about a 600 kilometer Kuiper Belt object, and the path went right over Washington, D.C. So I sent out a chat message. We have three positive, three recordings of the occultation were made in Maryland and at least a couple in Virginia. But there are over 130 people who observed that occultation, or tried it anyway. So a lot of them were clouded out, but the path went in the uncertainty zone included most of the USA and Western Europe. So we just have lots of observers trying it. We were not a success. We observed ourselves, but we're spending this week down in the Outer Banks. So we were too far south to see an occultation here. Altogether, we have at least 10 chords across this trans-Neptunian object. And so we're going to get some great data from it in the end. There weren't any rings detected yet or satellites of the object, but we haven't got all the data in yet. So we do have another occultation coming up tomorrow evening or tomorrow night, a little after midnight. And the path, it's a 12 and a half magnitude star, so it'll take a bigger telescope. And the northern limit of the path passes right over the southern part of the District of Columbia. It's a low numbered asteroid, which has a good prediction now with the Gaia data and everything. So anyway, it's in the Stardust, the event, and you can go to our iota.jhuapl.edu website for the Mid-Atlantic for more details. So now that's all I have, so we can get on with other aspects of the meeting.
Harold?
Okay. Are there any other announcements for the good of the order before I have our excellent Vice President introduce our speaker for the night. Okay, I'm going to mute myself and go. John.
It's a great pleasure to welcome back Julie McEnery, who spoke to us in September 2001 about discoveries by the orbiting Fermi Gamma Ray Telescope, of which she was the project scientist. Nancy Grace Roman was actually in the audience for Julie's talk. So it's quite wonderful that tonight Julie will tell us about the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope to be launched in the mid-2020s. Julie McEnery is now the senior scientist for high energy astrophysics at the Goddard Space Flight Center. She's also the project scientist for the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. Although she's still quite active in astronomy with the Fermi Gamma Ray Telescope, and with other gamma ray detectors, both space-based and ground-based, she now has added many additional lines of research, including those that include non-gamma ray data. She proposes new missions, and she's heavily involved in developing future missions. One example is the Probe of Extreme Multi-Messenger Astrophysics Observatory. Multi-messenger astronomy is astronomy that detects G waves and neutrinos, as well as other types of cosmic rays, along with light in any available frequency bands, from radio to infrared to visible to ultraviolet to X-rays to gamma rays. Multi-messenger astronomy measures the most energetic transient events in the universe, such as G wave bursts and gamma ray bursts and supernova. But multi-messenger astronomy also measures non-transient energetic phenomena, such as gamma ray pulsars and the ultra-relativistic jets from supermassive black holes, both of which Julie works on. Dr. McEnery's research includes jets from both relatively nearby supermassive black holes and from supermassive black holes so distant that they provide cosmological information about the universe when it was much younger. One of her other activities is a search for signals from the hypothesized annihilations of particles of mysterious dark matter. She also works on the detection and measurement of potentially Earth-striking astronomical objects. On the technology side, she works on the development of missions that will use economical CubeSats and even swarms of CubeSats, and also works on developing new types of detectors for gamma rays. Despite having that large and diverse list of research activities, she also works on outreach, providing opportunities for members of the general public to contribute to scientific progress via Einstein at Home. Dr. McEnery.
Thank you very much. That was a great introduction and considerably more information about me than I actually shared. So you must have hunted around a little bit.
PDS is a very useful tool.
So it is really a pleasure to be here. It would be a slightly greater pleasure to actually be here in physically as well as virtually, but here we are. As John mentioned, this is the second time I've spoken to this group. And the first time I was speaking about the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope. And this time, instead of talking about the results and observations of a gamma ray mission that had been in orbit for several years, I'm going to tell you about the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope, what it is, what we're hoping to do, what makes it special, and why we all should be very, very excited about it. So let me share my screen and get going. So hopefully you can all see that. I've put it in presenter mode. So this is an artist's picture of the telescope. So the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope is a NASA astrophysics flagship mission. It is the flagship mission that will be launched after the Webb Space Telescope. So in a sequence where you've got Hubble, then Webb, the next logical mission in that sequence of missions is the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. It used to be called WFIRST, and we renamed it last year in honor of Nancy Grace Roman for many things that she was that she was behind. I mean, she was, you know, this group probably more than me know all about her. For me, what was remarkable and makes me so proud to work on a observatory named after her is that she was such a complete person. She understood the science, she understood the politics, she understood the engineering, she and she could speak to a wide range of people. And that was why she was so effective in making things happen. So going back to the mission, what we have is a 2.4 meter primary mirror. So this is around the same size as the Hubble Space Telescope, which means we have roughly the same sensitivity. We have similar angular resolution, but our claim to fame is that we have a much, much larger field of view. So what you see here is right in the center is the Pillars of Creation, that very famous Hubble image. But it's embedded in the Eagle Nebula. And I think this particular image, you know, really makes it clear how much more you can get when you have an observatory with a very large field, of view. So what we're going to talk about today is the kinds of science that you can do when you have a large field of view, because it changes how you use the observatory. Instead of picking an object and going and looking at it, we now have the opportunity to do science that is getting away from simply looking under the lamppost, and we're in a more exploratory mode. We're looking for things that we don't know when they're going to happen, like a gamma ray burst or a supernova is an example of those. Or we're doing broad mappings where we're mapping out regions of the sky in a way that would be completely impossible with the field of view that we have with Hubble or Webb. Now, you could think that just that since the Roman field of view is about 200 times larger than the equivalent near-infrared instrument on Hubble, that we survey the sky 200 times faster. But in fact, it's much, much better than that. And I give an example here of observations of Andromeda. So to do these observations with Hubble, there have to be a very large number of observations to cover this, this galaxy. Those same observations could be made with just two Roman pointings. So that might sound like, okay, it's just a factor of 200, but it isn't, because those two Roman pointings, we haven't had to stop, slew, settle, wait, then take another observation, shift, stop, slew, settle, take another observation. So in fact, the enhancement in coverage between Hubble and Roman for this kind of a survey is well over a factor of 1,000. So that just gives you a sense of the power that we're going to have with Roman. And it's why the nature of how you use a mission like this will be quite different. So we're going to be in an era where we have the exquisite resolution and sensitivity of Hubble, but over a large field of view. There's a consequence of this. If we're viewing a large region of the sky and we've got the same high angular resolution, we've got the same high resolution camera, but just much bigger, we're going to have a correspondingly larger amount of data. Roman has a 300 megapixel camera that, you know, we will be reading out. So what you see here is a comparison between Hubble, Webb, and Roman in terms of data archives. So with Roman, we are sending down around 1.4 terabytes a day. The entire archive itself is going to be on petabyte scales. So we're anticipating that the way astronomers interact with Roman data is going to be substantially different from what's gone before. Instead of a model that you go to a data server, you download the data to your local computer and do the analysis, that is not going to be so easy or so feasible with Roman. So instead, what we're planning is to create data centers where people can come in and do the analysis in situ on computing that we provide next to the very large archives. And what I think that's going to do is make Roman data very accessible to a larger number of people. We have no proprietary period, so as soon as an observation is taken, it's made available to everybody, and we will be providing the computing needed to do interesting things with the data. So our mission objectives, our very first mission objective is simply to provide a wide field infrared survey of the universe. And we were top ranked in the 2010 decadal survey, who recognized that a very wide field near infrared survey of the universe would have a science return that was extremely broad. Are studying everything from galaxies, evolution of galaxies, quasars, clusters of galaxies, the very rich return. We also have a mission objective in cosmology. The nature of this observatory means that we have an exquisite ability to study dark energy and the fate of the universe. And I'll describe that in more detail later in this presentation. And then another major mission objective is to complete a census of planets around stars, so to complete a census of extrasolar planets. And I'll explain what I mean by that also later in this talk. And then finally, we have most of the science that I've described to you so far comes from our single primary science instrument, the Wide Field Instrument. We have a second instrument, the Coronagraph Instrument, and that instrument is a technology development, and it's really incredibly exciting. That instrument is, like physics magic in space. And I'll tell you a little bit about what the Coronagraph instrument is going to do to set us on the path to be able to directly image Earth-like planets around other stars. Okay, so moving on. So I'd like to, just to set the stage, say a little bit about why, what aspects of cosmology we're going to look at. So if you think about the universe and what it's made of, visible matter, that's stars, galaxies, planets, moons, us, makes up only 5% of the mass or energy in the universe. Around 27% is this material known as dark matter. And we know that dark matter exists because we can see the gravitational effect of dark matter in galaxies, in clusters of galaxies. We can conclusively see evidence that the dark matter is there from its influence on other matter around it. We understand something about the properties of dark matter by looking at the cosmic microwave background data, and we can see the effect of the presence of dark matter in the CMB data that was provided by WMAP and Planck. So dark matter is matter. It doesn't interact in most of the normal ways, but it does interact via gravity. And gravity, as you know, has a tendency to pull things towards it. So if you had asked someone in the early 1990s what we expected the universe to do, we would have said, well, there's a Big Bang that set the universe expanding, and that expansion might continue forever, or the effect of gravity might be such that it starts to slow things down. And in the late 1990s, a set of experiments were done to measure whether that expansion rate of the universe, is it slowing down, and if so, by how much? And what they discovered, to their astonishment, is that the universe is in fact not slowing down. In the relatively recent times, the universe has started to accelerate and expand more rapidly, which is extraordinary. And we can explain, we don't understand what's causing this acceleration, but we can quantify what it means for the energy budget of the universe. So we call the force that drives this acceleration dark energy. And one of the major goals for Roman is to understand dark energy and dark matter and how they influence the expansion history of the universe and how structure in our universe has grown over cosmic time. So we know that the universe is has structure. It's got stars, galaxies, clusters of galaxies. We can explore this structure as a function of distance, as a function of redshift, to make measurements of both the expansion history of the universe, because there are some structures that were frozen out early in the universe that just expand as a function of time. So if there's acceleration, that distance scale will seem distorted. And we can measure the positions of galaxies to understand how structure has evolved as a function of time. And that, of course, is driven by dark matter and dark energy. So if we can make a measurement of the expansion history and make a measurement of the growth of structure, what we're really doing is placing constraints on how dark matter and dark energy behave and have interacted. So one way that another way that we can do this, in addition to measuring the positions of galaxies directly, is to use a method known as weak lensing. And what we're looking at here is gravity can act like a lens to light. And what that means is if you have a large mass in front of galaxies, as the light from those galaxies passes through or nearby matter densities in between them, it distorts the light, and you see the shape of galaxies being slightly distorted. So this is hugely exaggerated in the animation that you're seeing here. The actual effects are, one in 10,000, and we can only measure them by making measurements of many, many, many galaxies and stacking them up and showing that there's correlations in the stretching and the shapes of those galaxies. But by using this method, we can make a map of the matter distribution as a function of distance. And we're directly exploring dark matter with this, because most of the matter in the universe is dark matter. So this is directly telling us about the dark matter distribution in the universe. We need to make these measurements. We will need a large field of view, because you want to measure a large number of galaxies. You want to measure the shape of a large number of galaxies. You want to measure the distance to a large number of galaxies. But you also need to be able to make all of those measurements incredibly precisely. And with an observatory like Roman, there's a third method of measuring the expansion history of the universe. And the advantage of having multiple ways of measuring the expansion history, multiple ways of measuring the growth of structure, is that each one of these ways of exploring the evolution and history of our universe has different uncertainties. And when you can combine them all together, you can make a much stronger, much more powerful measurement. So what we're, well, let me just keep going. So I'm going to make a complete transition here. So forget about the extragalactic universe, and now we're going to move much closer to home. And what you're looking at here is our own Milky Way, and looking towards the bulge. And I'm using this as a transition because the other major science objective for Roman is the study of exoplanets. And with Kepler and TESS, we've discovered several thousand exoplanets. And we've discovered those exoplanets by looking for dips in the light from a star as the planet crosses in front of that star. And that kind of technique, the transit technique, is sensitive to planets that are quite close to their host star. So what you see in this plot on the top right is the distance of the planet from the host star in AU on the x-axis, and the planetary mass on the y-axis. And what you see in this collection of blue dots is the region of in planetary mass distance from the host star that Kepler is able to make its exoplanet detections. And what you can immediately see from this is that using the transit technique, we're really only able to see planets, you know, almost, you know, but not, you know, almost to the radius of to 1 AU, to where our Earth is. And we do not have sensitivity to exploring what the distribution of planets at larger distances are. So we don't know how prevalent planets like Neptune, Jupiter, you know, the everything from Earth onwards. So we don't have a complete census of what planets are like in solar systems like our own, because we're blind beyond the 1 AU, beyond the Earth radius. And this is something Roman is going to be able to fix. And it's Roman will do this by using a different technique to detect exoplanets. So this technique also takes advantage of the lensing produced by the force of gravity, but on a much, much smaller scale. So the idea here is that if you take observations in towards a dense region of our galaxy, so make observations in a direction where there are lots and lots of stars, as the galaxy rotates, there will be a chance alignment between a foreground star and a background star along our line of sight. And in that circumstance, the gravity of the foreground star will lens the light from the background star. And when that happens, what we'll see is a magnification in the light from the background star. So this is illustrated in the sequence of images in the top left. So if you can imagine, if the foreground star is passing in front of the background star, you would just simply see this. Can you see my pointer?
Yes, we can. Yes,
that's great, because this is much easier to explain if you can. So this smooth curve here is what you would see in magnification of the background star due to a foreground star passing in front. If that foreground star also has an exoplanet around it, what you will see is a magnification due to the foreground star, but then you'll see an extra little bump that is the extra magnification due to the exoplanet. So we can, what we can look for is monitor a very large number of stars, look for this microlensing effect that tells us a foreground star is aligned with a background star. And then we can look for this short spike that lasts on timescales of hours that is indicating the presence of a extrasolar planet around that foreground star. And this technique is sensitive. So coming back up to the plot on the top right, this technique is sensitive from about 1 AU, so from about an Earth radius from the host star, all the way out into the equivalent of the outer solar system. So if we combine the microlensing measurements from Roman with the transit measurements from Kepler and TESS, we will finally now have a complete picture of planets around other stars. So I'd like to say a little bit about how the Roman works. I appreciate that to a group of people who work with telescopes, I'm probably preaching to the converted here, but anyway. So light comes in, it reflects off our 2.4 meter primary mirror. We have a secondary mirror that goes to a two-fold mirrors, then a tertiary mirror. And this is a three-mirror anastigmat camera, telescope, which means that we have a annulus with the best optical resolution, which is why our camera has this kind of space invader type shape. Let me stop it because I go back. Okay, so you've got a first fold mirror, second fold mirror, the tertiary mirror, which then sends the light through one of eight filters on the filter wheel, or we've got two spectroscopic elements. We've got a grism and a prism. So we can choose one of the eight filters for imaging observations, or either the grism or prism if we want spectroscopy. This is obviously not to scale. In fact, the filter wheel is much larger than the camera. Let me go back forward, which then allows us to produce our images of the sky. What I haven't mentioned so far is the Roman sensor and our Roman filters are all in the near infrared. And there's a reason for that. The near infrared is the right place for our observations in the search for exoplanets via microlensing. And that's because we want to make our observations towards the galactic bulge, which is a region where there's lots of dust. And if we were trying to make observations in the visible, we would have an extremely large extinction and we wouldn't see very far into the bulge. By making observations in the infrared, we can see all the way through to the galactic center. So we greatly enhance our chances of having these chance alignments that are needed to find the microlensing events. The near infrared is also the right place for our cosmology goals. I'm sure this group does not need to be told that as we look further into the universe, the light is shifted towards the red. So if you want to make observations at very early times, the infrared is where you want to be. It's also the case that galaxies have a smoother profile in the near infrared than in the visible. And this helps us make more accurate measurements of shape distortions with weak lensing. Unlike Hubble, Roman is in an orbit around L2. So in this animation, the sun is off here. You can see the moon orbiting around the Earth, and the L2 point is trailing behind. So we have about a 6 month orbit around L2. And this is really beneficial for many reasons. because we're at L2, we are not occulted by the Earth. Because we're at L2, we can keep a very stable thermal environment because we keep our solar array, which is also our sun shield, pointed towards the sun, and we have a very, very stable thermal environment. And by having a very stable thermal environment, it means that we can control very precisely the response of our instrument. So one of the things that we need with Roman for the cosmology measurements is to have a very, very well understood performance. We need to understand our point spread function to one part in 10,000. We need to understand how light as viewed in the detector maps to what we're actually seeing from the object. And this is much more easily done if your system is very controlled. We won't have the kind of breathing effects that you get in a low Earth orbit. So what we get to do is we keep our point spread function very, very stable. And if you've got a very stable point spread function, then you can characterize that point spread function, understand it very well, pipe that into your analysis so that when you're trying to make these measurements of subtle lensing effects on galaxies, you're actually able to do it. So I'd like to say a few words about our observations, because obviously you can build the best telescope in the world, but if you don't point it anywhere, you won't actually get any exciting science. So this observatory has been built as a survey mission. We have optimized to be able to slew rapidly, to be able to settle quickly, to maximize the amount of time that we're taking observations. We are not affected by occultations. We don't go through the South Atlantic anomaly. We really are optimized for a large number of short observations to map out regions of the sky. And our current plan is that we will have what we're calling core community surveys. So these are large surveys that provide the data needed to meet our cosmology and exoplanet demographic science requirements. And then in addition to these three core community surveys, we'll have at least 25% of the time available for general astrophysics surveys that can be proposed by the community, because we anticipate that there will be great ideas for how to use this observatory that we haven't thought of yet. But for now, what I would like to do is just say a few words about each of these core community surveys and what we think some of the science return is going to be. So I'll start with the first one, the High Latitude Wide Area Survey. And this survey is going to map out a fairly broad swath of the sky. It's going to be at least 1700 degrees, and our current candidate plan is a 2000 square degree region that we'll observe in multiple filters. And with this survey, we'll measure the shape of hundreds of millions of galaxies. We'll measure the distances to tens of millions of those galaxies. And those are the data that we will use to map out the structure of the universe as a function of distance, and to use those data to really understand both the expansion history and the growth of structure in the universe. Of course, there'll be lots of other things that you can do. Those data are also going to have active galaxies. They're going to have clusters of galaxies. So this is an incredibly exciting data set, and an unprecedented scale to have such precise information over such a large number of objects. So the High Latitude Time Domain Survey, I haven't spoken much about what this is. What we're exploring here is using supernova 1A. And a supernova 1A is where you have a white dwarf in a binary system. So a white dwarf is an endpoint of a modest-sized star. An accretion from the companion onto the white dwarf will continue until the mass reaches a critical value, at which point the gravitational force ignites the white dwarf and you have a large thermonuclear explosion. Because that explosion happens when you hit a critical mass, these are standardizable candles in the sense that the intrinsic brightness of these objects is can be made to be the same. So it's a little bit like having a light bulb. And if you have a light bulb of a known intensity near you, it's going to appear bright. And as you move it further away, it's going to appear dimmer. And if you can measure the brightness by knowing how bright it really is, you can figure out how far away it is. So this allows us to have an absolute measure of distance. And if you also measure the redshift of the galaxy that the supernova is in, you're going to be mapping out velocity as a function of distance in the universe, which is directly a measure of the expansion history. And this is, in fact, the technique that was used to discover dark energy, to discover that the universe was accelerating in the first place. But this discovery was made using a few dozen supernova 1A. With Roman, we're going to detect over 10,000, and we're going to detect them out to much larger redshifts than before. So we're going to extend this technique into earlier times in the universe. We're going to have exquisitely precise observations of how the light in the supernova changes as a function of time. And we're going to make that measurement in multiple filters. And this is going to allow us to very, very carefully study supernovae to make sure that we understand exactly how good a standard candle they are. So what you're seeing in the plot on the bottom left is redshift along the x-axis and a measure of distance along the y-axis, where a straight line would indicate that the universe was expanding evenly. And this is in fact curving. And what Roman is going to contribute is an ability to really continue these measurements out to larger distances and larger redshifts. So Hubble can do this, but Hubble has only a handful of supernovae, whereas we're going to have thousands. And then the final core community survey are observations of the galactic bulge. So now we're coming much closer to home. So on the right-hand side, you can get a sense of what we're trying to do here. So what we're doing is making observations towards the galactic bulge, because we want to have a very high density of stars. And we have seven fields covering about 2 square degrees. And we're going to make measure observations of those two square degrees every 15 minutes for six 62-day seasons. The orbit is such that the galactic bulge is only visible for around 72 days at a time, two times a year. So each of those observing periods is called a season in this. That's what we call it. So what this is going to do is we're going to be monitoring the brightness of over 200 million stars. And with this survey, we're going to see 100,000 bound planets using the transit technique. So this is the same technique that Kepler and TESS used to find their planets. So this is the technique that allows you to see planets close to their host star. So this is already more than a factor of 10, more than Kepler and TESS combined. But what's really crucial for what we're going to do is we are going to have over 1,000 bound planets from microlensing. And this is the population of planets that is going to complete our census, complete our understanding of what our populations of planets around other stars really like. In addition to that, the microlensing technique doesn't actually require that you have a host star. So we're also going to be able to find free-floating planets, planets that are no longer around their host star. And I'm going to switch gear entirely now. So everything I've described to you so far is the primary science that we expect to do with our main instrument, the wide field instrument. But we have a second instrument. And our second instrument is technology demonstration. And it's a technology demonstration to develop the technology to be able to directly image exoplanets. So instead of inferring that they're there from changes in brightness of observations of the host planet, in this case, what we're pursuing is seeing the exoplanet directly. And just to give you a sense of the problem we're trying to solve here, if you imagine you've got a lighthouse, and if I want to see a hot Jupiter, it would be the equivalent of trying to see a firefly next to the lighthouse, which is difficult. If I'm trying to find an Earth-like exoplanet, it's the equivalent of trying to see one bioluminescent algae next to a lighthouse. So the problem that we're trying to solve here in being able to make direct imaging of a planet around a sun-like star is an exceptionally challenging problem, because the star is so much brighter than the planet, and it is, the planet is so close to the star. So it turns out that the first paper to suggest using a space telescope to directly image exoplanets came from Nancy Grace Roman. So I think it is delightful that the mission that is named after her contains the technology demonstration that is really going to show the state of the art for doing this kind of science. So let me, I have another little animation here to show how this works. And this really, it's really amazing. So what you do here is, this is absolutely flying along. So, I'm going to just step it through because I can't speak nearly as quickly as this animation is going. So you could imagine doing coronography by having some sort of a light block. But that's not what we're going to do here. What we do is we place a mask in front of, in the light path. And that mask produces destructive interference at the center of the field. So what it basically does is it has destructive interference that creates a null, a hole, a block, it kills the light from where the star is. It then sends that light out. You have constructive interference somewhere else. So you add a stop that blocks the extra light that's produced. And from that, in principle, you're going to be able to see your exoplanet. So this shows, this is the stop. You can see on the image on the right what I mean by destructive interference. And when this happens, then the light from the star has gone away. And in principle, you can now see your exoplanets. But it's not really that simple, because there are small distortions in, let me just keep moving this along. I play it. Okay, here we go. So there are small distortions that are produced by distortions in the mirror in the optical system. And the effect of those distortions is going to create blobs of light that will effectively wash out our signal and make it impossible to see the exoplanets at the level that we need to. So what we do is we have what's known as a deformable mirror. So in here are hundreds of tiny little pistons, and we have a feedback loop that is measuring what these distortions are and automatically correcting for these distortions with the deformable mirror. And by doing that, we can then make the destructive interference more perfect, so that what's seen, let me just play this, so that what you see up here is now much darker. So if we let this play, you will see it start to, this is the deformable mirror making adjustments, and on the right-hand side, you can now see that the image is getting significantly, significantly better. And then we can start to see extrasolar planet emerging. And with better ground-based and data analysis, you can actually see that in this system, there are in fact multiple extrasolar planets. So I find this instrument really extraordinary because it really is sort of the magic of physics. I mean, using the wave properties of light to create a destructive interference pattern that effectively nulls out the light from the star, but uses the information at the same time to drive the deformable mirrors is to me just an extraordinary feat. So this technology demonstration, you have to show that you've got ultra-precise wavefront sensing and control. It's going to be the demonstration of the first use of deformable mirrors in space. You have to think very, very hard and carefully about how to create masks that are going to produce the destructive interference patterns that you need. You have to have exquisite cameras. You have to have ultra low noise photon counting visible detectors. And then we have really state of the art and extraordinary image processing. So this is a pathfinder. It's paving the way for what will be the flagships of the future, but it's a completely awesome instrument all by itself. And this brings me to my final slide. So I've spoken to you about Roman's mission objectives, and we've talked about cosmology, we've talked about exoplanet demographics. We've talked about the extraordinarily cool things that we're going to be able to do with our coronagraph instrument technology demonstration. But what makes me most excited is that an observatory that views the universe in the way that Roman will, where we're mapping out large regions of the sky, we're mapping regions of the sky in time as well as in space, we're going to find things we were not expecting to look for. We're going to have the ability to, we're going to map dark matter, not just dark matter in a cosmological sense, but by making measurements of a very large number of stars, we can actually map dark matter in nearby galaxies. But my main hope is that at some point you will ask for a speaker to talk about the results from the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope in around 10 years' time. And that the results that that person describes will be something I haven't even imagined. Because when you build an observatory that has an enormous amount of discovery potential, what you really want to be is surprised. So I think that we're going to do all the things that we plan to do, but that the most exciting thing we do, I can't yet imagine. Thank you.
Wow. Awesome. Okay, do we have any questions? Great. You can raise your hand, or if you want to turn your video on and really raise your hand. Viv, go ahead. Do you have a question? Oh, that's clapping hands, sorry.
Just amazing. Very exciting. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Go ahead, Jen. I mean, as John kind of alluded to at the beginning, for me, this is quite a big transition in research area.
Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah. Towards the end, you were talking about the deformable mirror. You don't have an atmosphere, so why would you have to worry about deforming the mirror?
The degree of distortion that we're talking about here is tiny. So there are still disturbances around L2. They're very, very small.
Hmm. Okay.
But the degree of control that we need to create the deep dark hole is also very extremely high.
Other questions? Go ahead, Jerry. Oops,
you're muted.
I got it. I'm very new to all this, so may I ask a very simple question, and that is, what is the timeline for everything, and where in Ireland are you from?
So I'm from Dublin. That question's easy. The timeline for this is, so we're building it now. We have, last week, we put the first flight sensors in the camera after much discussion about which detector would go where, because I didn't really describe the detail of the camera. What we've got is 18 chips made up into that sort of Space Invader type shape. So that's just going together now. The spacecraft is in the process of being built. The telescope already existed. So the telescope was donated to us from the NRO. And so what we did was refigure the primary and secondary mirror from those donated telescopes. And that all that refiguring work has been complete. The recoating is complete. We're in the process of building the mirror assemblies. We're approved for a launch no later than July 2027. And we're actually planning for October 2026. So the team is working towards a launch date in the fall of 26. But our agency approval is to 27. So in the media, you'll see both 26 and 27, and they're both right.
Thank you.
Okay.
Go ahead, Guy.
Given politics and everything else, What do you think the chances are that this won't fall into the problems that were faced by the Webb telescope that is now, I don't know how many years over schedule and over budget?
That's a good question. of course, we were, somewhat delayed, Our start was delayed by waiting for Webb to go through. So we're a different kind of mission. We have had a cost cap from the beginning. So we have taken a very aggressive approach on maintaining schedule and budget. And it's been made very clear to us by the powers that be that exceeding that is really not an option, that we would just be cancelled. At this point, I think we are far enough ahead now that I think we can pretty much guarantee that we're not headed for the same kind of budget or schedule increase that was seen by Webb. Because we actually have our flight hardware, we know it works. We've put it together. Some parts of it have already gone through their testing. As you proceed further and further through the process, there's fewer and fewer places for serious problems to emerge. So I'm not saying that absolutely it's going to be completely smooth sailing and there's no possibility of anything going wrong, but I'm not seeing anything going wrong. So far, we are building the things that we plan to build. They're working the way we expected them to work. They're coming in, at the cost that we expected them to come in at. It's not, it's not everything is like marching completely exactly the way that we expected it, but some things are more expensive and some things are a little cheaper. And then as stuff moves around, we try and adjust. COVID did not help. Who would have expected, a worldwide shortage of composites. But you figure it out, you readjust construction, build schedules to work around issues. So I'm hoping that we will be a demonstration that it's possible to build a NASA flagship mission without going way over budget and schedule.
Thank you.
Jay, you had a question. Go ahead.
A couple of little ones. Short one, what is the focal ratio of the telescope? And two, since it and Webb are both IR instruments, how will the two work together?
So I don't know the focal ratio off the top of my head. I apologize for that. Webb and Roman are really quite different. So Webb is further into the infrared, and it has a narrow field of view and a much larger mirror. So it's going to see much deeper and further in a much smaller patch of sky. Whereas, you know, so if you were to simply map from, you know, if you used Hubble as a starting point, what Webb does is go deeper and redder, and what Roman does is go broader. So the we'll look at different kinds of things.
Okay.
Other questions? Go ahead, Dave. David, you need to unmute.
Yes, I'm now. Okay, is the telescope, I take it, is passively cooled rather than cryogenically cooled? Also, I noticed one of your panels there of what you hope to accomplish was precision astrometry. So I was wondering how it's going to do that, how it's going to build off of the amazing work that Gaia has done.
So yes, it's we're passively cooled, not actively cooled, and that's that of course limits how far into the infrared we could go. The thermal noise gets very high if you go any redder than our reddest filter. Way that we're complementary to Gaia is because we make observations in the near infrared, we have the ability to see directly into the galactic center. So Gaia, because it operates in the visible, doesn't see so far into our galaxy because of extinction. So we will have exquisite astrometry towards the galactic center as a natural byproduct of the observations that we're doing for exoplanet microlensing. And from those, we can measure sort of populations of stellar populations and the structure at the galactic center. So that's how we're complementary to what Gaia does.
Okay, any other questions? Go ahead, John.
One of your slides mentioned was asteroseismology, and I suspect that much of the audience doesn't know what that is. Do you want to explain it, or I will?
Why don't you take a shot at it?
Okay. Our sun has seismic phenomena due to the fluid motions inside it, and you can learn a lot from that. And other stars do too, and that's what asteroseismology is about. You can find kinds of information that you just can't obtain any other way.
Right. It's what I find excellent, very interesting about this kind of approach to studying, whether it's studying the sun, other stars, or even neutron stars, is it's a technique that allows you to really probe the density structure in the interior of these objects, because the frequency of the oscillations that you see at the outside is driven by the details of the density and structure in the interior of the object. So it provides a unique way to sort of see inside something.
Other questions? All right, let's get everyone to maybe unmute so that we can do a nice round of applause for Dr. McKerney.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I really enjoy talking to this group. You're a delightful audience.
Since it was 20 years from the last one, we'll invite you back again in another 20 years.
Yes. Let's not wait that long. Let's have
it. It was 10 years.
Yeah, all right, 10 years. Okay.
Talk in 10 years. The results talk.
10 years would be good. Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah, it would be about right.
Yes. Yes.
Well, thank you very much for doing the enormous amount of work it took to put this together.
Well, thank you. I really enjoy talking to you folks, and hopefully, if there's a next time, we can see each other in person.
Let me ask you one question. Is there a way you can talk to congressmen and senators so you can get some more interest in this?
So I do occasionally, if I'm invited to, I speak to folks on the Hill, and every now and again. So for example, when I was one of the people very closely involved in the discovery of the multi-messenger event, you remember when there was a merging neutron stars that produced a gamma ray burst and a kilonova and gravitational waves, and it was a big deal. I was invited then. The congressman who was head of the appropriations committee that included NSF and NASA, you know, was interested in talk to us. As it turned out, he was really interested. He was an enthusiastic amateur astronomer, and like he was a lawyer by training. And he said that when he graduated from law school, he bought himself a telescope. So he just really liked to be able to hear from people. But I don't, because I'm a federal employee, I need to be a little bit careful about the perception of lobbying. So in general, I don't go unless somebody has actually explicitly asked me to. I like talking to folks on the Hill. You can sometimes listen to the narrative of this like super hyper-partisan political debate that you have, and you can, depending on which side of the line you happen to be, think that half of the group are idiots or the other half are idiots or naive or whatever. And you actually go and realize that our capital is filled with people who are surrounded by really bright staffers who are really interested and curious and listen, you know, regardless of which side of the political aisle that they come from. And when it comes to just, you know, talking about the science, it really becomes politically neutral. And I think it's important that we keep it that way, and that we do have people who communicate why the kinds of things that we're doing is valuable, you know, for the country as a whole, as well as just super exciting in its own right. Sorry, that was a longer answer than you probably expected. But
very welcome.
I'm concerned because of the long history of the cancellation of the superconducting super collider. And what a disaster that was.
Yeah, well, you know, honestly, I think that was partially political and partially idiotic on the part of elements of fractions of the science community. It turns out that science funding is not a zero-sum game, right? You cancel the SSC, it didn't result in lots more money going to other areas of physics. It just meant less physics in the US. It meant a loss of leadership in the US. And I think that any scientist who was involved in advocating against the SSC, you know, as once it was kind of up and running, bears some blame for the US losing significant leadership in in particle physics. I mean, you know, we haven't had a major accelerator on U.S. Soil. I think it's a real shame. But, you know, there's a consequence. You know, I think that we would be in, particle physics would be in a different place right now if the SSC had gone forward.
Yes.
And U.S. prominence would be too.
Yes.
Okay, Harold, do you want to end the meeting?
Okay.
Again, thank you, Dr. McKerny, and a final round of applause.
Thanks, all.
Thank you, everyone, for coming out tonight, and we'll see y'all next month. John, do you have a preview of what next month's talk will be about?
I do. I'm about to ask that speaker for the bio, but I'd have to look it up to jog my memory. It's actually about supernovae.
So I believe we've got December meeting is Brian Williams from
yes.
Goddard as well, Remnants of Supernovae.
Yeah.
Okay, so we will meet in December. That will be on December
11th.
11th, same bat channel. So we'll see you then.
Okay.
Have a good evening, everyone. Take care. Wayne, I see that you joined late, so we'll the video. I'll try to get that the video up soon, but you can also watch it off the National Capital Astronomers Facebook page because it did get streamed there as well. So you can watch it there if you want, and it'll be ready sooner. Yes, David.
I was just waving to Wayne, but I don't know if he can see me.
Yeah. So he's on. Not sure why his. Are you still trying to connect to audio? Okay. All right. Any other questions from anyone else? Then we'll. Log off. All right, everyone have a good night. Talk to y'all later. Bye-bye.
Bye.